What do you get when you cross Harry Potter with Jane Austen, throw in a dash of Dickens, a few blasted Heaths, and an ancient fairy king? You get an 800-page novel with footnotes that's being called Harry Potter for Grown-Ups. Actually, it's even better than that. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, the new novel by Susanna Clarke, appeared this fall to rave reviews. Writer Neil Gaiman calls it the finest English novel of the fantastic written in the last 70 years. It's a story filled with old London streets and dark forests, with historical figures like the Duke of Wellington, and with the adventures of two gentlemen magicians. I asked Susanna Clarke why she wanted to write about magic.
Because I loved books about magic and magicians when I was a child. C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia were a big part of my childhood, and I think provided a lot of the images and the stories at that time of my life, that it sort of was a model for me of what a wonderful book could be and how it could take me over. But it didn't occur to me to write a book of fantasy until I tried writing several contemporary novels and failed utterly. I was in Bilbao in 1992 and I was trying to write a detective novel. And it was a very bad detective novel. It had no plot. So I gave it up, and at the same time I wasn't terribly well. So I was rereading The Lord of the Rings by Tolkien and I was absolutely loving it. And when I finished, it just seemed obvious that that was what I should try to do next.
We should talk a little bit about your magicians, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Who are they? What are they like? They're very different from each other, it seems to me.
Mr. Norrell is a middle-aged man, but he was kind of born middle-aged, and he has a large estate in Yorkshire and a huge library of books that he's acquired painstakingly over the years. And he is in some ways almost more library than man. He is almost the physical manifestation of a library. He is all about books.
He's a fussy, very self-important man, too.
And he's fussy and he's shy and he's a bit afraid of other people. He's much more comfortable alone in his library than he is out in the wider world. And he's very jealous of the knowledge that the books contain. He's not at all sure that he wants to share it with other people. And Jonathan Strange is almost the diametrical opposite. He's charming, he's arrogant, he finds it very easy to talk to people. When he learns something about magic, he's perfectly willing to share it with anybody whatsoever. And also, he loves adventure. He goes to the Peninsular War with Lord Wellington. He really enjoys being part of that world and socializing with the officers, who are all very young and dashing.
Now, these are not magicians in the way that we've come to expect magicians. This doesn't seem to come out of the English tradition of magicians. There's no Merlin here. These are gentlemen who have acquired the skill of magicians. You do have the man called the Raven King, who is really more a figure of myth of the kind of thing we'd expect from a book of magic, isn't he?
Yes, he's a human child originally who was stolen away to fairy, as fairies often do steal human children, and he's much more romantic and his powers are much stronger. And there's a sort of idea that in each period of England's history, the magic reflects the history, the culture of the time. So by the time you get to the Regency period, it's more about libraries and books and scholarship.
Mm. When your story begins, which is right in that period, magic has been gone from England for a very long time. Everybody remembers that there was magic, and there are some who call themselves magicians but wouldn't, under any circumstances, actually practice magic. How, in fact, does magic come back?
At that point, Mr. Norrell is determined to prove that he is quite unique among the magicians in England, that he is something quite different from the theoretical magician. So he is determined to make a big splash at this point. And the magicians who are present, who are witnesses, are really elated and astonished. And some of them are a bit dismayed, because some of them really didn't want to actually see magic. They only wanted to talk about it.
I wonder if you would read just a little bit from the scene in the Yorkshire Cathedral when magic does make its return.
I will gladly do so. As the sounds of the bells died away, a voice began to speak from somewhere high up in the gloomy shadows above their heads. The magician strained their ears to hear it. It was an extraordinarily harsh, deep, and rasping voice. It was like two rough stones being scraped together, and yet the sounds that were produced were clearly intended to be speech, indeed, were speech. When translated into clear, comprehensible English, it was something like this. "Long, long ago," said the voice, 500 years ago or more, on a winter's day at twilight, a young man entered the church with a young girl with ivy leaves in her hair. There was no one else there but the stones. No one to see him strangle her but the stones. He let her fall dead upon the stones, and no one saw but the stones. He was never punished for his sin because there were no witnesses but the stones. The years went by, and whenever the man entered the church and stood among the congregation, the stones cried out that this was the man who had murdered the girl with the ivy leaves wound into her hair, but no one ever heard us. But it is not too late. We know where he is buried, in the corner of the south transept. Quick, quick, fetch picks, fetch shovels, pull up the paving stones, dig up his bones, let them be smashed with the shovel, dash his skull against the pillars and break it. Let the stones have vengeance too. It is not too late. It is not too late. Mr. Thorpe, who was a valiant gentleman, peeped into the chancel alone to discover who it was that spoke. "It is a statue," he said. And then the gentlemen of the York Society peered up again into the gloom above their heads in the direction of the first unearthly voice, and this time very few of them had any doubts that it was the little stone figure that spoke, for, as they watched, they could perceive its stubby stone arms that it waved about in its distress. Then all the other statues and monuments in the cathedral began to speak, and to say in their stony voices all that they had seen in their stony lives, and the noise was, as Mr. Segundus later told Mrs. Pleasance, beyond description. For York Cathedral had many little carved people and strange animals that flapped their wings. Then all at once there seemed a change in the sound, and one by one the voices stopped until the magicians heard the bells of St. Michael the Belfry ring for the half hour again. The first voice, the voice of the little figure high up in the darkness, continued for some time after the others had fallen silent, upon its old theme of the undiscovered murderer. "It is not too late, it is not too late," until it too fell silent. The world had changed while the magicians had been inside the church. Magic had returned to England, whether the magicians wished it to or not.
Is there a part of you that wishes we had magic? I mean, are we like those people who have been so removed from magic that we can't believe in it?
That's a very good question. I think that I wrote this book partly because I don't believe in magic. I wanted to write a book where people could escape into another world, as I'm so fond of doing when I read, and really be carried along by a story. But there's another aspect of the book, which is that I've tried to make most of the characters fairly sympathetic and also point out aspects of people's kindness to each other. And I think there's a lot of that in the book. I think sometimes that literature dwells too much on people being mean to each other and not enough on the more positive aspects. And I think that's the sort of magical thing that we have in the world.
Susanna Clarke's new novel is called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.